If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
Hello and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening. My old pal, David Collum, is the Betty R. Miller Distinguished Chemistry Professor at Cornell University. He moonlights as an internet gadfly, offering up his crisp observations on politics, culture, and economics. And he writes a massive year in review every time the holiday season rolls around. We talk quite a bit about Ukraine on this podcast, but it was recorded before Monday's rocket attack on a Russian barracks that killed so many soldiers. So the Christmas battlefield hiatus that we reference is probably over now. Let's hope we don't all get nuked. Here's my chat with David Collum. Dave, it's a pleasure to have you back on the podcast, and you have published your yearly year in review now, which is a thing of great interest to the alt news world, and I'm very privileged to have you on to talk about it. And the first thing I want to ask you is, has America completely lost its mind? Are we completely insane now in this country?
Yeah, I think we are. I mean, we go from people who are silent, ignoring the insanity, to the insanity and the outspoken insanity. But there's, yeah, I think we have, and it really does feel to me like there's some purpose behind it. It doesn't feel like we're just losing our minds in some sort of grassroots way. I can't identify what the proximate trigger is, what the cause is, but it feels like someone is. I feel like a monkey brain in a bell jar, and someone's zapping the electrodes and saying, let's see what happens when we zap this lobe, right? That's what it feels like to me.
Well, absolutely. And the most mysterious part of it is who exactly is behind it and what is their motive? And, you know, the Occam's razor simplest answer is, oh, well, it's the WEF, and they have somehow taken the many leaders in the world stage hostage, and they're pulling these puppet strings. But I find that kind of strange, too. And frankly, I find any talk about, you know, a Rothschild-Rockefeller conspiracy to be nuts, too.
Well, so you've historically not liked conspiracy theories. And I'm not a big fan of the big old school ones, you know, that George Soros is doing.
The Illuminati.
The Rockefellers are doing this. The Rothschilds are doing this, although they are doing stuff. But yeah. I think it, as you kind of put it, is kind of an intellectually lazy fallback position unless you have hard data.
You know, what always gets me about the Rothschild story is that nobody ever mentions the first name of any particular Rothschild who's involved in this.
There's no
real person involved, you know?
Yeah, and you know, one of the interesting theses that came out of a conversation with a friend of mine said one of the big players that no one talks about is the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And at first it caught me off guard, but I did think about the fact that they've been accruing wealth for 2,000 years, you know, yeah. And when people die, they leave it all to the church. And if you look in Ithaca, the Catholic Church has quite a bit of real estate, and we're just a little burg. So there is this question as to, the Catholic Church has this huge, presumably huge amount of resources. What kind of structure are they embedded in? And, it's so opaque that I don't have anything more to say.
I don't see them influencing, you know, the non-Catholic institutions.
Well, I'm not sure the Catholic Church, beyond, as a financial entity, is all that religious. At some level my point. There could be kind of the political/financial Catholic Church, and then the guys running around you know.
Yeah, but we don't even know, you know, who the financial guys are in the Vatican. You know, there's like one or two cardinals who are, you know, managing stuff, and that's all we hear about. And so, you know, in the absence of hearing a name or something, I don't really buy that. But
well, it doesn't go anywhere, right? It doesn't take you anywhere. But there is, you know, there are a couple of people in the Vatican who've been speaking up pretty boisterously about modern issues.
Yeah,
like Archbishop Vigano,
mm-hmm.
and he's been saying, he's been talking about the WEF and all these different groups and about wars and about how it's the industrial military complex. He's been spouting it off like he's in a podcast with us, right?
Well, let's put him aside and ask you, who do you think's behind this and what is their motive?
You know, well, I'm in a Dr. Zoom group that started as a sort of an anti-vax group. And they've had every imaginable COVID expert in that group. So you name them, they've been there. McCullough, Malone, Kennedy, Atlas, you go on and on and
sure.
on. And they are all now totally down a rabbit hole and convinced that that this really is some populate, that the vaccine itself is the bioweapon. I'm pretty confident that the COVID was developed as part of a bioweapons program. That I have little doubt, actually. But their belief, I think, in general, is that the vaccine is the actual bioweapon. Are you picking up on this IgG4 antibody story that came out Thursday?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty spooky story, right?
Yeah. Well, it's really just the nuts and bolts of how the vaccine is disabling people's immune system. I mean, we knew it was happening. This now they've kind of laid it out at the kind of level of the mechanics of the body.
That's right. And so for those who don't know what we're talking about, this is an antibody, which there's a lot of different things that are called antibodies, apparently. My 45-year-old genetics major is not very useful, but it allows me to talk a little bit. But it's an antibody that seems to play the role of keeping you from overreacting to antigens. So, and one of the things they talk about in the articles that are popping up fast now, that something like a beekeeper develops an immunity to the bee sting because of the bee stings, and that it's kind of Mother Nature's way of getting you to calm the hell down against these antigens. And these antigens are very, very low levels. And I think the number I saw to Alex Berenson, it went from some blood titer in some units, I can't remember, of, you know, 50 up to after your second vaccine, it doesn't do anything right away. And then it starts to climb. And then after your third vaccine, this antibody goes up to 2,500. But it's not right away. That's the weird part. It's not like you get this burst. This is something that occurs months later. And apparently what it does is it opens the door for the virus to come in unmolested. So now if you're triply vaccinated, and I don't even believe that triply vaccinated has great meaning because you can get different quality vaccines. So I think there's a
sure.
wide range of triply vaccinateds. But if you're triply vaccinated, the claim is that this part of your immune system is gone. It's broken. Mm-hmm. And that the virus can come in and camp out, and that there are other mechanisms down the chain that will take it on. But meanwhile, that first wall, the infantry right out in the front lines, is gone. And so the virus comes in and replicates and starts destroying things before you get any sort of immunological response.
Yeah, and that was the key to the point they were making, which was that
right.
people don't seem very sick because of this property of this particular antigen, but at the same time the virus is in there ravaging their bodies because the immune system is what presents the symptoms.
That's right. A lot of people don't realize that when you get sick, it is your immune system that you're feeling.
Yeah,
and it's not. It's the inflammation. That's you. That's your system. That's not the virus. And so now what you're doing is you're walking around with a virus that's replicating like crazy, and you're getting no red flags.
Well, there's an enormous kind of new wave of news reporting about excess deaths and sudden adult death syndrome and people dropping over and huge blood clots being found not only in cadavers, but in people who are living and ill. And I know that you follow Edward Dowd a bit. And,
yeah, I've known Eddie for about 10 years.
You have? Oh, yeah. From the investment community.
Yeah, and phone calls and stuff, yeah, over the years. Yeah, Ed and I were kind of tight.
Well, so you must hold him in some esteem.
I do. Ed is also intellectually flexible. He will entertain. He's always been able to entertain ideas that were unconventional. So it's not a surprise that he got into this one.
So my question is, do you think it is going to become so overwhelmingly self-evident that these vaccines are disabling and killing people that the public and the, you know, whatever the public health apparatus is, will not be able to ignore it anymore?
I would make the argument we're there, but they're still sort of ignoring it. So what we know, I think you and I would probably comfortably bet a serious amount of money that the collapsing athletes are non-statistical, right? That there's something going on there. Mm-hmm. What we don't know is real good numbers. There are some numbers. So like the soccer players are showing numbers, which they track. Cardiac arrests in soccer players, because apparently it's not that rare. So if you're a soccer player and you're pushing your heart that hard, if you've got something buried in there, you'll find it. And so some of the soccer players are dying at the rate of fivefold above the norm, right? And so there is something going on there. The athletes keeling over. You don't see 18-year-old cheerleaders keeling over like the other day. And but the question, what we don't know is the numbers, because everything's siloed, right?
Yeah, so, well, you can get kind of mired down in statistics. What I'm really wondering in terms of public sentiment is what is the American public gonna do and think when they come to the conclusion that their government is at war with them and is trying to kill them?
Well, what did the Russian, what did the slobs do when they realized that the Soviet Union was authoritarian, right? Nothing. There's nothing you can do sometimes. So I'm not convinced, you know, everyone knew Saddam wasn't getting reelected with a 99% voting rate, but, you know, it just, sometimes there's a so what, and I think that's the problem. So there was an interesting Twitter feed yesterday that the guy who's a meme, it's cat turd, right?
Whoever, oh yeah, sure.
It is, right? Very entertaining, actually. And he said, which protects you more, the vaccine or ivermectin? And it was 96.5% voted for ivermectin. So that story's getting out. It was a sample size of 70,000. And so that story is getting out, and it might be only through social media, but and not through regular media. But, you know, pretty soon at, you know, dinner tables and stuff like that, people are going to say, look, these stories were not correct, what we were told.
Well, I wonder whether they will put together the thread, which is not only were they told lies about ivermectin, but the purpose of it was to prevent the emergency use authorization from being negated, and therefore the liability shield of the drug companies from being obviated.
Well, I think the people who now believe ivermectin works probably have that message too, is my guess. It's kind of this package.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
so once you address this, well, why did they shoot down ivermectin? You say, well, that's so they could release the vaccine, and that's the only reason.
But then that takes you down one of those rabbit holes of darkness and evil. I mean,
very much so.
It's a very evil act to do that. They literally killed a whole bunch of people who could have been cured very easily.
That's why they can't admit it now. If Fauci comes out and says ivermectin works, he's a mass murderer right there on the spot. I think he is anyways, but.
Well, what if they're put on the spot? Well, let's say hypothetically that, at least the House of Representatives is going to be chaired by non-Democrats.
Right.
And I can't imagine that there isn't going to be an inquiry into Fauci and the NIAID and the whole apparatus that brought us the virus and the vaccines. And they're really going to have to answer.
Well, you know, so what you hope is that it has sort of the impact of, say, the Church Commission. you fear that it's all for show. Uh-huh. And so you know, look at the January 6th Inquisition that by the Committee of Seven and total D-bags. They didn't go in to learn anything. They went in to just, you know, spread their feathers and try to win a midterm election. And so I worry that the Republicans are going to do the same. When was the last time someone of importance actually ever got arrested and in trouble?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I worry that we will get. So as a right of center guy, I think the baloney that they throw at us over the next 2 years is going to be more palatable. But it's probably going to be baloney too. And I'll enjoy it better. I mean, I'll enjoy watching, you know, but if they don't bring Daszak and Barrick and the 17 virologists in front of them who signed the letter saying the virus was a zoonotic source, if they don't bring them forward and say, why do you lie? Mm-hmm. Then they're not serious. Period.
Well, I'm sure that I think Jim Jordan is going to be the new chair of the House Judiciary Committee.
He could do it.
And well, yeah, but he's going to be asking other people other questions, like all of those former CIA directors who claim that the Hunter Biden laptop was Russian propaganda. And, you know, if there are a few more people like him, you know, chairing those committees, I think that we might actually get somewhere. The question is, for me, would be how disruptive would that be to just American politics, and would it really provoke some kind of, you know, real uproar? I mean, we're so used to not seeing any reaction to any of this or any effective action against it that I think that guys like you and me and the thousands of people that I hear from as a blogger, I think they're, you know, we're all deeply demoralized by the fact that we haven't had a win on almost anything.
Including after, I would say, I don't think it's a partisan view that the Democrats pretty much screwed up the last 2 years. And I can cross the midline, as you know, from my Ukraine write-up, right? I'm not convinced that anything ever comes of it, because take, for example, there should have been morally. There should have been a red tie, if for no other reason, to send these meatballs who blew it badly to the bench to ponder how much they screwed up.
Yeah, sure.
And to say, look, if you blew it, you've lost a lot of positions. You got to ponder your strategy. You got to move back to the middle where Joe Sixpack wants to be. And you got to behave yourselves better. And then there was no red tie.
Yeah, well I simply concluded that the lawfare operations were so effective that they have literally just screwed the entire balloting system.
Well, that's right. But then it gets to the question of, are we at the point where the elections are just the equivalent of an election in the Soviet Union or in Iraq or something?
Yeah, they are for now.
They are
but
for
it,
now.
It doesn't mean that
Trump seems to really want to clean them up, well, because they all got reelected. They kind of like that part.
Do you think, well, here, you know, here's a case of something that is even more transparently awful, and that is the family bribery racket run by Joe Biden. Do you think
terrible.
That Joe Biden will ever be held accountable for his influence peddling?
No. No, too many people could go down is the problem. You know, look at Epstein.
Uh-huh, yeah.
There's maybe 1,000 people who could be brought to court.
The Johns.
The Johns, yes, the Johns. And the question I like to ask, you know, we keep hearing about child trafficking is a terrible, terrible problem. And once in a while, there'll be footage of some truck being opened up and, you know, 30 little kids, toddler-level kids, will be hauled out of there, and they'll talk about it as child trafficking. Well, they're not selling those kids to people in mobile homes. They're not selling those. They're not selling those to poor people. Those are going to people who are rich and powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, when was the last time you ever saw one get arrested?
Mm-hmm.
And if you can find the kids, you can find the Johns. You can find the purchasers of the kids. And they're not.
Yeah. When we talk about Johns, we're talking about the, you know, the clients who are
right.
accessing prostitutes and children and all of that.
Right. And they're not getting arrested.
Yeah.
And well, so
that's, you know, obvious.
It just shows me. So I'm a believer at this point that that there really is a very large sort of pedophile ring within the elite. I'm fairly convinced that that story's legit. Uh-huh. I don't have my brain around the details. But, you know, I don't know if Pizzagate was real, but the idea of Pizzagate, I think, is real.
Mm-hmm.
And so
I'm sort of going in that direction, too. I found it preposterous at first, and now, you know, now you really got to wonder.
You do, and then you ever looked up Tony Podesta art collection?
I have. I did back in 2016-17 when, you know,
before
when
it was
that was going on. Yeah, very spooky,
before
very weird.
Filtered. You can still see his art now, but you have to go quite a few pages in to start finding the really disgusting stuff.
Uh-huh. And, you know, I would advise listeners to try using the Brave search engine instead of Google.
And
maybe even instead of DuckDuckGo. What's your assessment of Donald Trump now that you've had 7 years to observe him and his place in politics and, you know, maybe in history?
Well, I think the absence of the red tide was in part to try to erase everything Donald Trump. So I think all the people who tied themselves to his wagon were taken out of the kneecaps because they're saying, look, we've got to snuff out this MAGA fire. And I think both parties agree is the problem.
You think Mitch McConnell's going to survive?
I hope not. I mean, Mitch McConnell's as bad as any Democrat.
I know. That's why I'm asking you.
Yeah. No, I hope not, but he's pretty entrenched. He's an old man, so he's likely to die of old age in there.
Oh.
And so I'm really antagonistic to Mitch McConnell. And the Republicans, you know, they get opportunities to fix something, and they don't. And so I think philosophically I agree with what they say better, but I'm not convinced. I don't like this idea that it's all just one big party and there's not two parties, because that allows you to stop thinking, and I hate that part.
Yeah, me too.
But at the same time, they do have one common interest, and that is they all want to get reelected.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So,
and I think they have a common interest in wanting to protect themselves against accusations of grift and, you know, the grift that's really been going on, you know, at such an enormous volume.
But you have to get back. You have to go back 15 years at least to find someone who actually got in trouble. A lot of guff.
Mm-hmm.
But
who was that, by the way?
Hastert would be the one I go to.
He.
Then there's the guy in.
Hastert was the Speaker of the House.
What's that?
Hastert, for listeners, was the Speaker of the House. He was the longest-serving Speaker of the House in American history.
And so someone took him out at the kneecaps. And there's that guy, I can't remember his name, but he's from the Chicago area. What a shock that is. Who got sent to prison for embezzling something like $27,000 worth of postage.
Oh, gosh.
Which is comically stupid by modern standards.
Yeah.
But he got sent to jail, which tells you it's not that because he got caught doing something wrong, but because someone took him out. Right? That's when Dominique Strauss-Kahn got charged with rape.
Right, and he was going to be the next president of France.
Yeah.
Well, you have an analysis of Vlad Putin in your year in review, and I think we would both agree that he certainly appears to be an effective national leader. He doesn't appear to me to be insane. If you actually listen to his speeches, or at least the translations, and read the transcripts, he seems to be a very cautious and sane person. And yet, you know, he's been turned into the devil. And what's going on with him?
Well, so I would say the core of my write-up this year was Ukraine.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
And I would say that I've been watching Putin since about 14. I think I first picked up on it, and that was during the Maidan protests and the coup and CIA-led coup in Ukraine, and it kind of brought him into my view as something to care about. And since then, I've kind of watched him, and I've had this interesting sense that he was a Russian nationalist, that he cared about Russia, that he was loyal to Russia. In fact, one of the things about Putin, I broke my rule when I write about something. I try not to read books because I don't want to just spit back someone else's narrative. But I really needed to know more about Putin, and so I actually read a book on Putin, which had bizarre patterns to the book that made me suspicious. But he above all else, loyalty is everything. And most people say, well, yeah, he demands loyalty so that he can be an emperor or dictator or whatever. But he also demanded loyalty from himself when he was a subordinate. So when he was on your team, you could absolutely positively depend on him. And he would not, if he couldn't do it, he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't sign up. So when he decided to go into a political position, he resigned from the KGB. They said, you don't have to. He said, yes, I do. And so, so the evidence is, and in this book, which half the book was very unflattering, from the second that he got elected president, the book turned dark on him. And either he changed immediately as president, or somehow from that point on, someone got in and edited the book. I mean, it was like a light switch. So up until that moment, the book was pretty balanced. My wife was listening to it. It was an audio book. And she said, you know, it's not an unflattering view of Putin. He's got obviously got problems. But there's something about him that sort of keeps your attention. And then he gets elected president. From that point on, the book was just nothing but he's an awful person and everything is his fault. And there was not one positive word from that point on in the book.
Well, he couldn't have been more clear about why he felt it was necessary to mount a special military operation in Ukraine. And
well,
simply
that
we had turned Ukraine into a de facto NATO operation, and he said that he wouldn't stand for that.
That's right. And he'd been telling us that for years.
Yeah.
And NATO had been flipping him off for years. And so what a lot of people don't know is that Ukrainians were getting massacred by Ukrainian Nazis for years before Putin moved in.
Right.
And these were ethnic Russian Ukrainians. These were people who really view themselves as Russian. And you know what? There was a vote for them to join Russia. And everyone said, oh, that's farcical. It's like, absolutely not. That region of Ukraine really were much more Russian than Ukrainian.
Well, in fact, I think two of the late Soviet leaders were born there, Khrushchev and Brezhnev.
And so over the last 10 years, Ukrainian Nazis have slaughtered up to about 15,000 Ukrainians in that region. The Azov Battalion literally are Nazis. I'm not using Nazi metaphorically. These guys believe in Nazis. They're anti-Semitic. They're ethnic cleansers. Stepan Bandera is their idol. And he was one of Goebbels' buddies that he was fighting. He was fighting the Soviet. He and his Nazis were fighting the Soviet Union with the Germans. And so what the average person who's got their yellow and blue flag up and thinks that Zelensky somehow is a super great guy and this is just about good and evil, you couldn't be more ignorant than that. So if that's you, it is time to stop squealing and start reading because Zelensky's a very bad guy. And you don't need... It's not to say that everything he did was wrong, but he's a very bad guy and he's done very bad things. And somehow we're sold that he's just a sweetheart. And he's not. And the Nazis are real Nazis. They're not just metaphorical Nazis. And they slaughter people and they torture. And there's interviews of Ukrainian doctors saying that we're getting Russian soldiers in the hospital who've been castrated. There's just awfulness going on.
Well, so much of this is just performance art.
Right. And the problem is you don't know which way it is. Now, if we had a press in the United States and in the Western world that wasn't a complete sack of garbage, we could turn to the press and say, tell us what's going on.
Oh, let me ask you about that, because you made the point in somebody else's podcast that the press is perhaps the greatest enemy of the American people, of all the things that are, all the groups and persons and that are bedeviling us, that they're the worst. And you said that they were the worst because Big Pharma, pays for what, 3/4 of their advertising.
Right.
Okay. That didn't satisfy me, and I want to get you beyond that.
Okay.
I mean, how do you explain the fact that you've got so many people, so many individual reporters out there on so many networks and newspapers, et cetera, who are just writing lies. How could they all be bought off, these individuals?
Well, I think it's one of these things where I'm in the middle of a book called Poisoner in Chief. It's about CIA dastardly deeds. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a self-sorting group. So if you can't do that, you can't do the job. And so you get told to shut up, right? Look how many, look at the vaccine campaign and how many people lost their jobs because they just couldn't toe the line.
Uh-huh. And so but at least there were people, who couldn't toe the line. But you'd think that there would be a few whistleblowers or turncoats, you know, at the New York Times, the Washington Post, or CNN, who would just, you know, come out and say, you know, that we've been doing these evil things.
And then they get fired.
Well, so what? They do it knowing they're going to get fired.
Okay, so if you go over to Substack, you'll find them. You'll find Alex Berenson. You'll find Glenn Greenwald.
Two guys.
You'll find the guys who are trying to tell the truth. Matt Taibbi. Yeah. And what's interesting is, to me, the bulk of the ones that strike me as the real heroes are former liberals.
Sure. Well, and they must be appalled at their colleagues.
Well, but it also, here's where the bias could be. That is, it could be that I'm seeing a person who crosses the line going from the right side to the left. Uh-huh. I might be looking at them as just despicable human beings who have sold themselves. So I could have an internal bias. And then when someone goes from the left to the right, I go, oh, what a hero, right? So there's that risk. But, you know, Bill Maher is a left winger who crosses the midline and goes to the right. Uh-huh. So to me, I view Bill Maher and Tucker Carlson as like mirror images of each other. And well, they both have the capacity to say things you go, that doesn't really sound like who that guy's supposed to be. And the answer is yes, because they occasionally say stuff that really makes sense to them that doesn't happen to fit their politics. Mm-hmm. So those are heroes. Those are the good guys.
The Vaulted program, backed by David McIlvaney's ICA Group, allows gold investors to participate for as little as $50. In times of high inflation, you might be looking to put your money into real assets, something like gold, perhaps, which has proven itself throughout history as a reliable way to protect and grow your savings during periods of market uncertainty. And you may have heard that the best way to invest in gold is to actually buy physical gold. Well, Vaulted is the mobile platform and app that allows investors to purchase physical gold. The gold is real, and it's stored at the Royal Canadian Mint. You can also take physical delivery right to your home if you'd like. It takes less than a minute to set up an account. Vaulted offers the lowest transaction fees and features the best cost structure in the industry. You can buy and sell your gold at any point, and there's even an automatic savings program called Vault Plan that investors can set up to automatically purchase gold every month. Buying or selling gold is as easy as buying stock. There is no minimum investment either. You'll even get a personal advisor to speak with at any time if you have any questions about the gold markets. Learn more today by clicking the link in my show notes or by visiting kunstler.com/vaulted. Vaulted is backed by the McIlvaney Financial Group, which owns ICA, one of the largest and longest continuously operating full-service gold brokerage firms in the United States. And now back to the show. I wonder if we're ever going to find out what was going through the head of a guy like Dean Baquet back in 2016-17. He was the editor, executive editor of the New York Times.
Well, here's the question, though. When you're running a paper like the New York Times, in the olden days, everything was being collated through some central office. But now I think the Times and online, you know, articles and stuff, it's just flowing in almost just digitally now. So I can write an article and submit it to the New York Times and some knucklehead posts it. And so I'm not sure the New York Times has this overseeing body that really looks at the big picture and fact checks and say, go back and get confirmation before you publish that story. I think it might just be this random buckshot.
They can't have no quality control whatsoever. That's almost unbelievable.
I would say the evidence for a future case, they seem to be worthless.
Well, let's get back to Ukraine. We appear to be in some kind of a holiday hiatus of the war. And my own sense of the action coming up in 2023 is that Russia is going to put a decisive end to this. But the catch is, they probably have to do it in a way that's not going to absolutely humiliate the United States, because that would be very dangerous.
I agree with that. But the United States, so if you read and listen to, I binge watch. Once I found guys who seemed to be telling the other side of the story, I dug in deep. And guys like Colonel Douglas McGregor, mm-hmm. Scott Ritter, who's got kind of a sketchy look to him, but he really is a smart guy, and John Mearsheimer, and I think his name is Scott Black or Stephen Black. I keep forgetting that for some reason because I read a ton and watched a ton. They're telling a story that Ukraine is getting their ass completely kicked. And so this idea that I'll keep giving Ukraine weapons so that because they're on the cusp of winning this thing and beating off the evil horde from Russia, when in fact what you're doing is you're arming them and sending them to their deaths. Uh-huh. And the analogy I drew was it's like when Longshanks sends the Irish out on the field and then shoots the arrows into the middle of the battlefield. And he says, you didn't care if he hit the Irish as long as he also hit the opponents. Uh-huh. And so I think NATO's treating Ukraine like expendable people. Uh-huh. And I think it's that simple. And so
it's not like NATO has the mojo to come in when Ukraine is utterly exhausted and prosecute a war against Russia. They don't have the troops. They don't have the armaments. NATO doesn't.
They also, you know, we still have that whole nuclear threat. And so I think they've been pushing us close to the nuclear war way more than any sane person would do.
Right, but that's not a strategy.
Well, it's not. It's an idiotic strategy. So it appears to me as though before the war started, Putin was trying to say, look, guys, this is getting real now. You got to stop this. And it wasn't just about NATO's incursion into Ukraine, because we'd been arming Ukrainians for a decade heavily. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But it was also in the middle of February, there's one day where bombing of in the Donbass region where Ukrainians bombing Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. Picked up dramatically. And it one of the theories is that Putin realized at that point he had a massacre of ethnic Russians that was commencing. And so he said, I got to move now. So there's actually a belief that he accelerated his plans because mm-hmm. of the bombing in the Donbass. When I watched the war from the beginning, I could not see evidence that Putin was bringing the horror of war the way Sherman brought it to the South intentionally. Right? Sherman brought the war to the South, so the Southerners would go, oh my God, this is really awful. We got to stop, right? And so he wanted to make the horrors of war vivid. And I think Putin did not. Putin was trying to sucker the Ukrainian army to protect the cities and do end runs and take out the Nazis. He wants to take out the Nazis.
I don't think he wanted to leave Ukraine a failed state, because that would be
right.
a bigger problem on his doorstep than, you know, anything.
He'd have to rebuild it. And so the evidence early on was that a lot of the footage was just garbage. Right. So you'd see burned out cars and you go, you know, that looks like Detroit to me. You'd see, you know, buildings were smashed up. There was footage of Mariupol, and I'm watching the footage. I'm going, this damage looks like it's old. And in fact, I think it was from years of civil war, uh-huh. destroying and rotting Mariupol. And so what I did is in my write-up, I showed... And I said, look, this war seemed to start very slowly. And I said, it doesn't look like Saving Private Ryan. It doesn't look like Baghdad on day one. It looks different to me. And my wife kept saying, what are you saying? I said, I'm not seeing the war. I'm seeing grandmothers being interviewed about how horrible the war is. I'm seeing people squealing about how horrible the war is. I'm not seeing the war. And I think Putin explicitly, partially because of his bad, bad personal experience in Chechnya, he didn't want to have a lot of casualties, and he didn't want civilian casualties, and he didn't want to destroy infrastructure. He needed to get control. He needed to keep NATO from getting control of Ukraine, and he needed to denazify Ukraine, because the Nazis were the ones that the CIA tagged to be the fighters. Uh-huh. So then what happened is then we or one of our proxies blew up the pipeline, and then we or one of our proxies blew up the Kerch Bridge, and I think Putin changed direction. I think he said, okay, now it's getting real. Let's make him suffer. And so he didn't destroy a lot of Ukraine, but he took out important infrastructure that's going to make it a very long, cold winter.
Yeah. But now we're presumably waiting on some kind of an offensive from the Russians. They've amassed a fairly huge army.
Well, they say that the Russians didn't want to do anything while the ground was still thawed because it would get muddy. And so they were waiting for the analogy I drew is like they weren't mudders, right? A racing term. And I said, but once the ground's frozen, they're going to play like the Green Bay Packers on Lambeau Field.
Yeah.
and so I think that they were waiting to move their heavy equipment in on frozen ground.
And so what do you think is going to, how is it going to play out in 23?
I don't know, because it depends on NATO's response.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so NATO keeps, NATO's pretty up to their asses, not just in providing weapons to the Ukrainians. The real destruction being done against Russia is not being done by Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. This is being done by NATO operated super sophisticated weapons that you couldn't train a Ukrainian to use. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of the damage being done to Russia, there's strikes inside Russia. Those aren't Ukrainians doing those. And so we're in a very dangerous situation because we really are in a bit of a direct NATO Russia fight now.
Mm-hmm. Except, you know, as I said, NATO, NATO, except for the U.S. and that's questionable. NATO cannot prosecute a war against Russia. They just don't have.
And they didn't want to either. That's the other thing, is at the beginning of the war, I think the evidence was that no one had a taste for this war. But the U.S., which is really the effectively NATO.
What's the chance that NATO just bails on the U.S. on this thing?
Well,
I think it's pretty good.
I do. In fact, one of the theories is that at the end of this, NATO will break apart.
Uh-huh.
And I'm actually kind of hoping for that. I think NATO has outlived its usefulness. Putin pointed out that they're talking about moving certain key weaponry into, I can't remember where it was, but Putin came out and said, look, you're within 7 minutes striking distance of Moscow. We can't tolerate this.
Sure.
And if we had Russian-based weapons within 7 minutes of Washington, D.C., some country would be turned to glass real fast.
I want to move into some other areas, especially finance.
Okay.
Do you think that Americans will stand for a central bank digital currency that would be imposed on them with a state's ability to control their lives?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah, I do. I think we're being numbed.
Uh-huh.
I that's why I spent so much time in the beginning of my write-up on Eric Hoffer's,
The True Believer,
mm-hmm. Right? Propaganda has been formally developed for millennia, but it really got quite sophisticated in the 20th century. And I think what could disrupt it is actually the COVID story, where people finally say, holy cow, they lied to us at a profound level. Then the average joker on the street is going to stop believing anything. So I was talking to someone the other day and I said, I'm never getting a vaccine again. He said, none? And I said, none.
Yeah.
How do you know what's in it?
Yeah.
And so when you lose, there was a poll, I don't even know if I mentioned this earlier in the talk or just in my head, but there's a poll which I did mention it, the 96% support for ivermectin over the vaccine. Something's uh-huh. breaking through.
Uh-huh.
So I think there it's possible, but there's all psychology studies have shown all along that you can just keep duping people.
Well, there's one other thing that might get in the way, and that is a very serious economic crash, and not just stock market crash, but, you know, people losing their jobs, the middle class getting ravaged and destroyed, unable to buy another car if they had to, having their homes repossessed. I mean, real hardship. And it looks like we're heading into that kind of a situation. I think that could be a game changer, too.
I do, too. And in fact, I talked about this, too. The right blames FDR for bringing in the welfare state. You know, the guy who gets the blame is Woodrow Wilson. He's the one who decided we needed another branch of government that's basically the administration. But FDR, he was an insider, right? It's not like he was some outsider wackadoodle. And what I think FDR recognized was that there was a battle between the Trotskyites and the capitalists. We're in the middle of a depression that looked like it was the capitalists' fault. And so we were at great risk of the Trotskyites winning. Uh-huh. And I think FDR recognized that the forgotten man, using Amity Schley's term, the forgotten man, if we didn't compromise big, we were going to lose that guy. And so he compromised big, and the right loves to blame him for big government. But I think he saved capitalism.
Well, yeah, I'll take your point on that. What I'm thinking, though, and I've thought this for a long time, that there is a macro trend out there that tends to go against the grain of the macro narratives that I'm hearing. And that is, namely, the macro trend is for things to become local and downscaled. And that, you know, that single trend tells me that, you know, any attempt at centralized control of anything is not going to succeed in the years ahead.
Well, so, but here's where it gets really weird, because that inadvertently plays into the theme of technocracy, Patrick Wood's technocracy series that he's done, where the idea is that the sovereign states, and in particular the United States, being able to project its force, is the image of the technocrats is that technology will rule the world, which is digital currency, things like that, and that sovereign states are an antiquated idea. And so to the United States, those are fighting words, because we have the best army, the best navy, we have the reserve currency, right? We own the world in many, many ways. And if all of a sudden sovereign states are no longer the dominant model, and it's more regional, then there's a kind of a plot thickener where you go, okay, so it's regional. What happened during COVID? Well, we had regional decisions being made by governors and by mayors to shut down schools when they shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. And so it's not clear going local is going to work. You know, school boards, did they really shine under the conditions? Not a bit.
Yeah. It could be very uneven, I think, but I'm not sure that it, how that's going to go for the, you know, the World Economic Forum.
I agree with the possibility that that's going to happen, but I'm not sure. You know, I'm a pro-choice, I'm a pro-choice. I used to call myself an atheist, but I've come to really understand that our system is built upon Judeo-Christian ethics, and that although I don't personally want to be involved, I should not lose sight of what religion does to provide guidance for society. Uh-huh. And I've written about that in defense of religion. And I worry those sort of institutions are being torn down, and that's a real problem. Mm-hmm. That's a problem to me.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the mechanics of finance, the simpler ones. You know, we are self-evidently in an inflationary situation, mm-hmm. but it seems to me that when enough damage is done by inflation, that we'll see economic activity slow down dramatically, right. And right. Debts will not be paid, and money will disappear when that happens, and then we'll be in a deflationary situation, a deflationary depression, where nobody has any money. What's your view of how that equation is going to work going forward?
Well, I think the actual number of times where countries actually successfully inflated their way out of debt is nearly It nearly does not exist.
Uh-huh.
It nearly exists. I mean, they're really, you know, countries like Argentina, in the end, they end up defaulting. Weimar Germany, they didn't inflate away their debt. They ended up defaulting again. The inflation hurt the locals, but it didn't get rid of sovereign debt.
Uh-huh.
And so the only case, the best case anyone can come up with to inflate away debt is the United States post-war, where the bond market was, you know, the bonds were priced like 9% below the inflation rate, and the interest rates were 9% lower than the inflation rate, and so the bond investors got slaughtered. So it was financial repression of the same kind they're trying to pull off now.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that's what got rid of our debt. But what also got rid of our debt is we controlled 80% of GDP of the world.
Yep.
And so it's very hard to separate those two. And Canada had a debt problem, and they took it out. But if you actually look, the inflation rate was never very high. And so it really looked like they kind of just blocked and tackled their way out, too. And so I don't think there's good examples of inflating away debt. And so I think in the end, as you said, it ends up in a deflationary problem.
Well, what do you suppose is going to be the tipping point for that exactly? How does that mechanism work in your mind?
Well, so it depends how you define money. So deflation, you know, people who define money as either the situation is either inflation or deflation. You can't use a binary language to describe something so complicated. And so that's the first problem. So language is corrupting ideas at that point. I think that there's things that have what Doug Nolan, I don't know if you know Doug, but Nolan calls moneyness, the idea of moneyness. So for example, Bitcoin, right?
Sure.
Bitcoin is not really money, but if you've got $500 million worth of Bitcoin, I can guarantee you, you're not spending like you're earning $50,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that takes on a moneyness. If you have $1 million worth of treasuries, you operationally have money. And so when things take on moneyness, now, therefore, when something that has taken on moneyness collapses, so let's say for laughs, the entire crypto world collapses. Let's just hypothetically, I'm not predicting it. I think it's going to be a long battle to see who wins that thing. But all of a sudden, you just lost $2 trillion of perceived spendable wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a deflation. That's a deflationary problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because we took things out. And if you have a house and your house is worth $1 million and you're going to retire and you say, well, I can sell my house, move into the old folks' home, and that'll pay the bills. If that's all of a sudden worth only $400,000. You're screwed. So that's the deflation too. And so there. If you think of it collapsing the value of perceived wealth, you can a collapsing stock market has a deflationary quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that makes you feel less rich by losing it.
Well, one of the catches in that moneyness picture is that there are so many things now. There are so many instruments out there that have a quality of moneyness, and they're so abstract. Their relationship with real capital and real wealth and real productive goods is so tenuous that,
like $2 quadrillion worth of notional value of derivatives. How's
exactly.
that work for starters?
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. It seems to me that that's very dangerous situation when the level of abstraction in things that have moneyness gets that bad.
Well, that seems to be a Stein's law problem, right? That seems to be a situation where you say, look, if you've really got $2 quadrillion worth of derivatives, but it can't possibly be true. Think of it as $2 quadrillion worth of NFTs. Then at some point it does have to stop. At some point, that I'm a big fan of regression of the mean. I'm a big fan that markets are very thermodynamic. They can be kinetic, right? The market can race up all you want. I look at analyses of the equity markets, and there are so few that actually talk about actually the value of the assets in real productive terms.
Mm-hmm.
So a company like Facebook could go away today. And besides the fact that it'd be shareholders got hammered, we would lose nothing as a society.
Right.
right? Back in the old days, if you took out U.S. Steel, you took out some serious wealth creation, or Alcoa, or RCA, or General Electric, or any of those, right? That would be loss of wealth. But Twitter, we have our big company, Tesla, for that matter. Tesla's just still a twinkle of someone's eyes, and we should probably mention the fact that, you know, that one of the big stories that I picked up on this week, and I knew this to be true, and I'm tracking sort of what it takes to build a battery of an electric car. And it's a horrific story, right? You have to pull 500,000 pounds of earth out of the ground to build one battery for a car. And the nasty one that came out this week, or should I say shot across my radar, was that essentially 100% of the cobalt, which is critical to every electronic device that has a lithium battery in it, which is every electronic device, the cobalt comes from open pit mines that are being dug by hand, by slave labor, being paid a dollar a day.
Children.
And adults.
In Congo.
50,000 at a time in the bottom of this pit, smacking away with mallets and hammers. They like teenagers because they need more strength than a four-year-old can provide. Mm-hmm. But it's so as you're buying your electric car and you're feeling all smug because you think you're being good, that electric car was built on the back of slave labor. And there's no escaping it.
You have a great phrase. Maybe you can talk about it a little. The sanctimony industrial complex.
Yes. I created that one this year. I was very proud of that. The sanctimony industrial complex that keeps reappearing. That's the Eric Hoffer connection, too. That's the mass movement connection. So for those who haven't heard me mention this, Eric Hoffer's 1953, The True Believer, in my opinion, is a truly brilliant book. I think you said you read it in high school or something. I did not. And it's just a brilliant book, and it describes what we're seeing today. Mm-hmm. It just describes everything we're seeing, and it's about mass movements and the fanatics and how they get oxygen and the stupid stuff they do, and so the true believers that say, oh, if I buy a Tesla, I'm doing good for the world.
Well, and speaking,
you're not. You guys are buying Teslas. You're not helping the world right now. Maybe someday, but right now you're not.
Well, speaking of the sanctimony industrial complex, you're out there on an Ivy League campus, and what's your assessment of the cancel culture situation these days? Are the young people getting sick of being insane? Is there any sign that the administration of your Ivy League school has had enough of diversity, inclusion, and equity, and the high salaried deans that are running that racket?
I think the real high fever has broken, but I think the damage done by it's huge because I don't think cancel culture was a grassroots movement either. I think it was something that was constructed by smart people who said, how do we suppress free speech? Uh-huh. And then they said, well, this would do it. And so I think canceling people is a way of making everyone think twice about what they say. Mm-hmm. Because you really think, I mean, you're totally independent of the world. So you can say stuff and it wouldn't faze you except for, I guess there could be consequences. I, on the other hand, could incur the wrath of God. They got me pretty good in 2020. I just shut up and let the storm blow over while I watch university in a war mode trying to figure out what to do. Uh-huh. I'm ready for the next one. I don't think there will be a next one, but I'm ready. And the next one, I'm taking the gloves off and I'm gonna come out with fists flying.
Are you going to come out with lawyers?
I'll come out with lawyers. I'll come out on Tucker Carlson. What I'll first do, though, is I'll approach Cornell and let them know what I'm game for. Because I'm a big fan of Cornell. I think Cornell is a phenomenal institution. Mm-hmm. And so I will approach Cornell and say, look, they're going at me again. If you guys handle this well, I'll just shut the hell up again. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's up to you. You make the call. But if I have to fight these guys, I'm going to fight them ugly.
Good.
I am going to fight them butt ugly. So I'll give Cornell the ability to let the storm blow by. And if I might go out there, but I've never said it a single disparaging thing about Cornell, the institution. or even the administration. Try to find me a faculty member who says favorable things about their administration. And Cornell didn't handle it badly the last time. They ended up denouncing me, and it actually caused the thing to go away. So I said, you know, that was okay. But I know some trustees, and they said, no, they should have shut up. I said, yeah, but it did go away. And so I really can't bitch.
So where are the students at? Are they, they've been pretty insane.
It's hard to say because no one, I know if you're a conservative on campus, you just shut up. Uh-huh. It's oppressive. And in fact, I called out the Sanctimony Industrial Complex on campuses and said, okay, during this Ukraine war, while everyone's worried about, you know, the well-being of Ukrainian students, what about the Russian students? What about the kids? It's nothing to do with them. Are they being abused? Have you checked into them to see what their mental well-being is? Right? And so... So the Sanctimony Industrial Complex is intended to be the most pejorative imaginable term to those who pick up a cause and, like total morons, don't actually try to learn about it and then just go squealing about it. And that includes the climate change crowd. I'm a big believer in resource depletion problems, which you and I have been talking about for 20 years. Uh-huh. I'm a big believer in pollution problems and destroying the earth problem. I get all that. But I don't think CO2 is going to destroy us. And I don't believe the model. I don't believe it could be happening. I don't believe any of the mathematical equations can possibly approximate.
Yeah, and let's remind the listeners, you're a distinguished chemistry professor at an Ivy League school.
Which in some sense shouldn't matter, except for the fact that, you know, some people think, well, there's no incredible. I got into the climate change story when I said, look, there's no incredible who doesn't believe this model. And they said, oh, yes, there is. And I said, send me some names. And they sent me a bunch of names. And they were elite schools. And I said, yeah, but they're probably guys who shot down some model, but they didn't shoot down climate change. And I went and read it, and there were these ultra famous scientists saying the whole climate story is garbage, just garbage. And so one of the very first big lie in the climate change story is that no one credible doesn't believe it. Head of the National Academy of Science says it's the biggest hoax in the history of science. You know, Freeman Dyson, Will Happer, advisor to many presidents. The American Physical Society put together a committee to look at it and came out of it and said the science is garbage. Mm-hmm. Now, I know there's good climate scientists trying to understand the sort of the micro stuff. But the big picture, we're all going to die from climate change, is garbage.
And yet it seems to be running global politics.
Well,
at least in Western Civ.
$50 trillion grift.
Uh-huh.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
You give me my fair share of that $150 trillion, I might spout off about climate. You know, if I'm trying to write an NIH grant, the first two pages are gonna be, here's how I'm gonna help the health of the country. Right? And I have a very good write-up because I've done collaborations with pharma, and I can say we helped with this drug and with this drug and with this drug, you should therefore fund me, and they fund me.
Yeah.
But if you're doing geology or you're doing atmospheric sciences, and your introductory paragraphs are, look, climate change is a serious problem. You need to fund me because I'm going to do this. That's rational science. That's rational thinking for a person who's trying to raise funds.
Uh-huh.
So you play along. You play along. That's how science works. No one gets funded. I can guarantee you, if I went to the NSF or the DOE with a grant that said, our preliminary data shows that climate change is crap, I'd never get funded. I would never get funded.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I can see that.
And therefore, the entire scientific community is selected for, in this massive Darwinian experiment intellectually, for those who can swallow hard and say, climate change is a problem, and I agree, and let's pretend like we're going to fix it.
So science has turned itself into the emperor's new clothes.
At some level, they have, because there's so much money rolling around now, and mm-hmm. and companies are saying it, right? You know, the companies that are mining cobalt out of the ground with slave labor are happy to talk about woke stuff because they just don't want to talk about the slave labor from whence their batteries are coming.
Yeah.
So but there's an estimated $150 trillion to be spent on climate change. in the next 30 years is the round.
Well, I don't think the capital's going to be there.
I don't either. And I don't think the elements in the Earth's crust are there.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
But one of the things I've done in my investing portfolio is I've invested in the miners, because even if we just do classic wealth creation, they're going to have to mine stuff out of the ground to do it. Yeah. And if we do this stupid, you know, build electric cars, even though our grid can't handle them, they're still going to be mining stuff out of the ground. So it seems like I win either way.
Well, speaking of miners and speaking of metals, you some years ago made some pretty good bets on gold and silver.
Yeah, that was 22 years ago.
Well, yeah.
But 22 years ago, 1999, I rolled my equity portfolio into cash and gold.
Okay.
And then 20 years ago, I took a lot of cash and put it into energy.
Uh-huh.
And so my best decade ever by a country mile was the noughts, where everyone else was getting killed by two massive bear markets. I was rocking.
I'm wondering what your
20, I went back into the energy again.
What's your take on where gold and silver are going this year?
This year, I don't have a clue, because it just doesn't do what it should do. Mm-hmm. And you know, markets do what they're supposed to do, just not when.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can be dead right for way too long. And so if I'd love to have a better idea than gold. I would love to have a better idea. And I have committed a chunk of money to energy.
And you're not too hot on Bitcoin or things like it.
No, I'm not. But I talk to the hodlers all the time, and they seem to think there's some price level that I'll buy it at. And I go, no, that's not it. There is some moment in time where I'm all of a sudden going to have this eureka saying they're going to survive, and therefore they are important now. And that's when I buy.
Well,
the Bitcoin guys are convinced that the state can't touch them. And I am convinced the state can crush them if they decide to.
Well, I'm convinced that the whole thing depends on a reliable electric system. And I'm not at all sure that we're going to have that.
Well, I agree with that, too. And I don't need something that's sufficiently complicated and confounding, and all these VPNs and all this crap, that I have to worry about that, too. So I kind of like white bread investment. So if I'm going to buy gold, I don't want to buy some weird gold fund. I want to buy gold or, you know, Newmont Mining, uh-huh. You know, something like that. I just sort of real white bread investments. And so if you put a gun to my head and said, put your cash to work, I'd probably flop it all into the various traditional energy companies.
What's your take? What's your quick take on the markets, on the equity markets and the bond market?
Well, so, and this I've been predicting for years, and that is that in 2008 and 2009, and in every equity downturn for the last 40 years, the bond market always cushions the equity market. So what happens is the equity market beats the crap out of people, but your 60-40 portfolio, your bonds go up in value because the interest rates drop out of safety. And so your 40% of your portfolio actually appreciates. And so your overall pain is not that bad. Now I said, we're going to get to the end of that rope, and the bonds are going to wreak havoc on the investors, and the equities are going to wreak havoc. And for the first time in my living memory, and I don't know, even in my reading, equities and bonds are going to wreak havoc on you simultaneously. And that's exactly what this year was.
Uh-huh.
Your bond portfolio and your equity portfolio took out about the same amount of blood this year as they did, each one did. And this idea that bonds are safe is stupid. I've read enough books by guys who said, look, bonds and equities return the same over the long run. And that turns out to be true, with the exception of the post-war period. There's about a 30-year period in the post-war period where if you take that out and you consider 170 of the previous 200 years, bonds and equities tied.
Well, but we are in sort of a new era.
I think the bonds are going to crush people. I think the equities are going to be uninvestable. And that's why I'm now rushing into energy, because I think I have a meme in my thing where the customers are with a realtor in front of a house, and they said, they said, well, we'd like to look at something cheaper. And she said, oh, I'll bring you back to the same house tomorrow.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
It's like great buying opportunity. There'll be a better one tomorrow. And so I think the markets are going to be uninvestable. And if you think that's not rational, just look at the Nikkei. There's no way. Let's say you were confined to the Nikkei, which a lot of Japanese were, right? They just said, oh, I know the Nikkei. I'm investing in the Nikkei. I'm Japanese, right? Uh-huh. And in 1989, for about the next 20 years, there was no way to make money. Just no rational way. And I was on a Twitter space with George Noble, and he said, well, you could short it. I said, no, you couldn't. It took 15 years, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You die, you go broke shorting a market that drops that slowly. and so I think the markets could be uninvestable. I think we could go through a bear market that lasts 20 years.
So you're talking about a slow bleed out rather than
grind you to dust.
Rather than a sucking chest wound?
Well, I don't think sucking chest wounds burn off all the fuel.
Uh-huh.
So my definition of a real bear market, a real correction that takes not only takes out the froth of the price, but it takes out attitude. And the last time we really adjusted attitude was 67 to 81. The end of the 67 to 81 bear market, where over 14 years you lost 70% of your capital gains.
Uh-huh.
That left investors with no taste for equities. That was the bottom.
Nasty.
And so I think we're going to do that again. And again, I've said this many times. If you go from if you take the 20th century S&P 500 inflation adjusted, and you draw a line from the peaks, 1906, 1929, 1967, whatever peaks you can find. And you draw a line and you don't ask how, draw it laterally across the time scale. And you don't ask the question, how long did it take to recover? You ask the question, how long did it take before we attained that price for the last time, not the first time? And it turns out in 1906, the price of the inflation-adjusted S&P was exactly the same as in 1981.
Wow.
And in 1929, it was exactly the same as in 1981.
Wow.
And so the point being is, and now, a guy named Ron Grice, or Grice, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce his name, he's got an S&P plot that shows the S&P corrected for not CPI inflation, but for M2 money supply change, which strikes me as a much cleaner inflation metric,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you can't lie about it. You can't pretend something's cheaper when it's not. It's just the measured M2 money supply. And in theory, if the assets are appreciating, they should be appreciating relative to the money supply, right?
Mm-hmm.
And over the 100 years that he plots, it's dead flat. It wiggles around, but it's flat.
Wow.
So the question is, did the S&P gain nothing inflation adjusted for 100 years? That's the question.
That's a very curious thing.
It's a disturbing question.
Yeah.
And that means all you get is dividends.
Well, Dave, we have come way over the finish line. You know, talking to a guy like you really, I think, requires a 3-hour podcast.
Well, and I've done a few.
I know you have, and I feel kind of inadequate to the task of talking to you because of that, there's so much to talk about.
Well, but the other thing was the foursomes we did with Tommy Kerrigan and Tom Luongo, those were fun.
Yeah, they were fun.
they were. Did you see they were beating on you after you left the second one?
Oh, yeah. My girlfriend brought it to my attention.
Could you hear me trying to get him to dial it back? I'm going, okay, yeah. That was a funny joke. But, you know, they're all just jokes. But I'm going, if someone jumps into this podcast midstream,
yeah,
they're going to think you're a beast.
But, well, I didn't take it hard.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Because I like all you guys.
I like that homeless look you delivered that day. That was good.
Thanks. All right. You know, I'm going to check in with you sometime in the early half of the new year, 2023. Mm-hmm. We're heading in there. It's going to be rough and ready, I think. A lot of action, a lot of things to talk about, and you know, maybe our country will get its head screwed on a little bit.
Maybe.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
It would be. It's not my baseline bet.
Yeah, well, I hear you. All right, Dave, we will ride again. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.